Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for joining The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. A potentially groundbreaking summit on U.S.-North Korean relations is taking place this week in Hanoi, Vietnam, with President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un meeting for the second time in a year. Will Kim give up key parts of his country's nuclear program in return for U.S. concessions, which could provide a transformative economic boost to North Korea? Joining the Crisis Next Door to discuss the summit is retired Army Colonel David Maxwell, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. Colonel Maxwell served in Asia for over 20 years, including as a planner for the United Nations Command, Combined Forces Command on the Korean Peninsula. Colonel Maxwell, thank you for joining the Crisis Next Door.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here.
Colonel, is there more pressure on Trump or Kim to reach a deal, or is it equally shared?
That's a great question. I think generally it's equally shared, but for different reasons. I think President Trump, first and foremost, North Korea is a threat. We have never resolved the nuclear issue, despite trying very hard since 1994. We've never been able to resolve it. And of course, the threat has been growing, not only from a nuclear capability, but also for an intercontinental ballistic missile capability that threatens the homeland. So President Trump certainly is under pressure to solve this threat to the homeland, but also threat to our alliance partners, not only South Korea that is under missile and nuclear and conventional threat, Japan as well. So he's definitely under pressure to make things happen. And of course, domestic political considerations also enter into it. Now, North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is certainly under pressure because of the strongest sanctions that have ever been imposed and enforced on him. The sanctions are having an effect, despite since the Singapore summit last June and some relief or bypassing of sanctions by China, by Russia, and of course North Korea's continued illicit activities designed to bypass the sanctions. But the sanctions are having an effect. Kim Jong-un needs resources, needs hard currency, needs access to international markets, and so he really wants sanctions relief. And so those are the two sides to the coin. One thing we should keep in mind, though, President Trump can't unilaterally lift sanctions. Congress, U.S. sanctions are imposed by Congress. U.N. sanctions, obviously, we have a vote in the U.N. Security Council, and we had unanimous support for the recent sanctions going back to 2017. But sanctions shouldn't be looked at as a bargaining chip or a concession. The sanctions are very clear that North Korea must comply with the requirements to denuclearize, to end the missile threat, end proliferation around the world, end its illicit activities, as well as stop its human rights abuses. So the sanctions require a lot from the North, and that's because the North is a rogue state, a pariah state, and that is conducting illegal nuclear activities and illegal actions around the world and causing the horrendous suffering of 25 million Koreans living in the North.
Speaking of unilateral, Kim has preferred to deal directly with Trump. How big of a deal is that for the process?
Yeah, that's what he's been doing. And he really, for him, the stars are lining up both with President Moon in South Korea and President Trump. And it seems obvious and clear that Kim Jong-un thinks he can get a direct deal with President Trump. And of course, President Trump is the great deal maker. And so there's some logic to that. And of course, we've seen since Singapore, it really, Kim did not allow working level negotiations to occur. because he apparently thinks he can get that deal from Trump. And so it wasn't until in January, when Kim Jong-chol came to Washington and brought with him the new special representative, the DPRK special representative to the U.S., Kim Hyok-chol, who is now the counterpart to the U.S. special representative to the DPRK, Stephen Biegun. And they've met twice in Pyongyang and meeting beginning last week in Hanoi. So working level talks are beginning, but they have not had sufficient time to really work out any details in preparation for a summit. And most likely, they have just been preparing the agenda and the talking points and the orchestration of the summit. It's very important that Kim Jong-un or that President Trump looks Kim Jong-un in the eye and say, you know, from here on out, we have got to have working level negotiations and no further summits until the working level negotiators bring agreements to which both leaders must agree.
Is there a fear that Trump could try and strike a deal on his own? And what would that mean?
Yes. Well, there's been lots of speculation about what might happen. There's talk that he might give a declaration of peace. And, of course, the White House talking points released last Thursday really do play into Kim Jong-un's narrative about building trust, establishing peace, and then denuclearization. In the Singapore summit, it's been the U.S. position, denuclearization first, then build trust, and then change the relationship, normalization and lifting of sanctions. So they're always been at odds. But last week, the White House came out and said specifically that President Trump wants peace on the Korean Peninsula, peace throughout the world. And so what we might see is a declaration of the end of the Korean War. That, of course, is problematic if that is only agreed to between the United States and North Korea, because we must remember that in 1950, North Korea attacked South Korea. It was a blatant attack of the South. The United Nations recognized that the North was the aggressor, and the UN Security Council resolutions 82, 83, 84, and 85 called on member nations to defend the freedom of South Korea against the aggressor North. And so we should remember that this was really a Korean civil war. The United Nations did not declare war on North Korea. It intervened under the UN authorities. The Chinese did not declare war on South Korea or the U.S., and did not officially enter the war because they only sent the Chinese people's volunteers. So the war is between North and South. It was a civil war. And so for the United States and North Korea to declare an end of the war without South Korea is an obvious attempt by North Korea to split the ROK-US alliance, which is one of their the key pillars of their strategy, divide and conquer. Divide the ROK-US alliance to be able to conquer the ROK. That is one area that could be a concession made that might not be good. And of course, the other part of such a concession is that North Korea, China, Russia, even some in South Korea and the United States would use that as an excuse to push for the removal of U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. My worst fear, a deal that could be made, is Kim Jong-un would say, I will stop my ICBM program in return for removal of U.S. troops. And of course, if you've been following the news, the U.S. and South Korea just concluded an agreement called the Special Measures Agreement on Burden Sharing, and which is the funding by the Korean government, the stationing costs for U.S. troops on the peninsula. Hard-fought negotiations failed, did not meet the agreement in time. It had to go into overtime to be able to ultimately reach agreement. And South Korea agreed to pay another $200 million in addition to the $800 million that it already spends to support the cost of U.S. troops, which is over and above the $10 billion that South Korea spent building the largest U.S. military base outside of the United States. That agreement, if Kim Jong-un says, that, you know, South Korea really doesn't want to support U.S. troops. Why do you keep them there? I'll give up my ICBM program, which will end the threat to the U.S. homeland if you withdraw the troops. And that deal could be really catastrophic, because the 28,000 U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula are not there to defend South Korea. They are there to deter an attack by North Korea. And if it's in our interest, which I think it is, to prevent war, the investment of 28,000 troops to deter an attack by the North is pretty good investment, especially because what happens on the Korean Peninsula is going to have global effects, at least global economic effects, because the peninsula is at the nexus of the second, third, and 8th to 11th largest economies in the world, two nuclear powers, and some of the largest militaries, North Korea, fourth largest in the world, China, Russia, and of course South Korea, and the U.S. presence. So that small peninsula is at the nexus of great power competition, and if conflict breaks out, it's going to have global effects.
North Korea wouldn't even need its nukes for South Korea. Seoul's so close to the demilitarized zone, it could just open up with artillery and rain fire on Seoul. Obviously, Kim wants the troops, U.S. troops, removed from the peninsula. Do you think that's his number one goal in these negotiations, to get the U.S. off the peninsula?
It is certainly one of the most important. I think his near-term goal is to have sanctions relief. But what you are articulating is really his strategy. His long-term strategy, which is, of course, based on subversion of the ROC political system, coercion of the ROC and the United States, extortion of the ROC, the United States, and international community using provocations to gain political and economic concessions. All of this is designed to drive a wedge between the ROC and U.S. alliance, to get U.S. forces off the Korea, off the Korean Peninsula, to give Kim the advantage militarily, so that if his subversion, coercion, and extortion lines of effort don't bring unification, he has the option to use force to unify the peninsula under northern domination to ensure survival of the Kim family regime, which is the fundamental, vital national interest of North Korea, survival of the Kim family regime. And the strategic aim is to unify the peninsula under northern domination to ensure survival. So that is his strategy. And, of course, the question that we have to ask is, has he given up that strategy? And is he willing to denuclearize in return for economic investment? Or is he conducting a political warfare campaign, or the long con, to use these negotiations to be able to create the conditions that will allow him to execute his strategy and campaign plan that will, of course, be catastrophic?
Do you think that it's possible that the U.S. and President Trump could be fooled by this seeming change in Kim's personality over the past couple of years, that it seems a bit warm and fuzzy now, that perhaps this could be part of that con that he's perpetuating?
Yes. And I think, you know, I can't speak for the president's mind. You know, I can only read his tweets like everyone else. I do know that his advisors are well aware of the strategy, the long con, and are not about to be duped by Kim Jong-un. But there are tremendous political pressures, and the president could see opportunities that we don't see, and could strike a deal. I am optimistic that as long as the president listens to his advisors, we will be okay. But there's no predicting what the president might do, you know, behind closed doors in a one-on-one situation, and what he might agree to.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door, and we're talking about the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un with retired Army Colonel David Maxwell, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. How will we know that North Korea is serious about denuclearization and not just offering up the test site that was blown up last summer or the rocket test stand that was frozen last summer? What steps does Pyongyang need to take?
That is great. Great question. First and foremost, the ideal thing would be for it to declare all of its nuclear components, nuclear facilities, nuclear weapons, all its locations. That is probably unlikely. It looks like what we're going to see is an offer of Yongbyon, the main nuclear facility, which has about 70% of its nuclear capability. Apparently he is going to offer the dismantling of that. And of course, this will be the third time that we buy it. In 1994, in 2008, they blew up the cooling tower. In 1994 was the agreed framework. And so this would be the third time we buy Yongbyon. But what will demonstrate the sincerity of Kim Jong-un's willingness to denuclearize will be if he allows inspectors, international inspectors, present on the ground to observe and supervise dismantlement and removal of fissile material and rendering those nuclear facilities as irreversibly unusable. And so that is how we're gonna really see the sincerity. And of course, most all past negotiations have broken down on the verification process. The North is reluctant. It does not want to give up information about its capabilities and their locations. Kim Jong-un apparently told President Moon that if he did that, he would be giving the U.S. a target list for attack. And so that's one part of his paranoia. But in the past, it has been verification, and he doesn't want to allow a normal arms control regime process where there are inspections, challenge inspections, and permanent deployment of inspectors and technical capabilities to monitor facilities, which they've had some at Yongbyon in the past. But of course, they've reneged on their agreements and past negotiations have failed. So we're going to see if third time's a charm. He may want to do that. I also think that we need to keep in mind, the president has said that all he wants is no testing. And it's been over 400 days since nuclear and ICBM tests. But we should keep in mind that the lack of testing does not mean there's been any reduction in the threat. And three times in 2018, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-nam, and Ri Yong-ho, Kim Jong-un and his prime minister and his minister of foreign affairs have said that they perfected their nuclear deterrent. And Kim Jong-un said on January 1st, 2018, that they were ready for mass production. So the lack of testing maybe because they've completed their program. And so we should not be lulled into a false sense of complacency because there have not been tests. And furthermore, they very well could have developed the computer capabilities to conduct simulations, which might make or reduce the need for physical testing of capabilities. So again, there's been no reduction in the threat, in the nuclear or missile threat, just because there has not been testing. So that, to me, is not a demonstration of sincerity. They really must allow inspections, challenge inspections, and begin the process of turning over fissile material weapons for rendering safe and moving off the peninsula.
Even if Kim provides a declaration of North Korea's facilities, nuclear materials, missile sites, everything, how can it be verified that that's a thorough list and it's not leaving off a few places?
Right. Well, it's very likely. North Korea is masters of denial and deception. They have some 5,000 underground facilities. In 1999, we inspected an underground facility we saw being constructed in Kumchang-ni, and it turned out it was an empty hole. But it sure appeared to us like they were building some kind of facility related to its nuclear programs. So they are masters at denial and deception. If they turn over a list, we will assume that it is not complete. We will verify it and compare it to our intelligence, what we know. But of course, we also have to be careful because our intelligence, and identifying sites that are not on their list, potentially could expose sources and methods. So we'll be very careful about how we go about challenging the information that they provide us. It is a tough intelligence problem to verify the information that they give us. But again, this has to go back to a commitment to denuclearize and denuclearize the North. commitment to inspections, and you know, if in that way, then we will be able to work the verification process and declaring and determining where all its nuclear facilities and material is located.
Colonel, how do you see China's role in these talks? Has it changed since the first Trump-Kim summit? Do you think the trade war with the U.S. will have any impact on China's role in the Korea talks?
That's a very complex issue. I think for the most part, the trade issue and the Korea issue has been separate. I think it's important, though, to realize when China looks at North Korea, it doesn't look at North Korea. It sees the United States. And so relations between in the Korean Peninsula is really about how China sees the U.S. in Northeast Asia. Now, China has what we call the four no's, or three no's: no war, no regime collapse and instability, and no nukes. So they're a pretty good baseball team because they're batting 600. But their primary objective is no instability or regime collapse or war on the peninsula. And of course, 2017 and fire and fury and the potential for military action is probably what drove China to support the sanctions, not as a way to change North Korean behavior, but to use the sanctions really to show that they're trying to moderate North Korean behavior, but they're really fearful of U.S. military action and what that could do to the peninsula. North Korea and China do not, although they're allies since 1961, there's really no love lost between them. North Korea has always been masterful at playing the great powers off against each other, going back to Kim Il-sung and Mao and Stalin in the Korean War. So China does not really control North Korea, although economically it could strangle the North if it chose to. But again, when its prime directive is no war and no instability and collapse, it doesn't want to cut off all resources to the North. It doesn't want to provide excessive military aid either, because it doesn't want to go to war. But it is not about to solve the nuclear problem, solve a U.S. national security problem, and, you know, just out of the goodness of their heart. And so we have to look at what interests are in North Korea, you know, for China in North Korea. And of course, they want to maintain really the status quo.
In return for freezing its missile tests, the U.S. in return froze its military exercises with South Korea. Do you think China could be benefiting from that?
Well, in a way, you know, they benefit from any weakening of the U.S. military and the, you know, and the relative capabilities of military forces. Now, the unilateral suspension of the exercises, you know, took place last summer. That has a readiness impact. However, U.S. and South Korean commanders have taken creative steps to mitigate some of that loss of training, to train other ways other than having the large-scale exercises of Ultra Freedom Guardian, Key Resolve, and Full Eagle. They are continuing to train. They're maintaining readiness. So there has not been a significant decline. It just becomes harder and requires more creativity and longer times to train. But the commanders are ensuring that they are maintaining sufficient readiness. The ideal way is to be able to conduct large-scale exercises, and those exercises are computer simulations that simulate North Korean attack on the South and prepare commanders, their staff, the air component, the ground component, the naval component, the marine component, the special operations component, to orchestrate joint and combined operations in the defense of the Republic of Korea. And so, you know, these are not exercises that are hostile to the North, that are a threat to the North. They are based on the realization that North Korea is prepared to attack the South, and the combined military force has to be ready to defend.
Colonel, if there's no progress from this meeting, what does that mean for this process, and is this process done?
Well, it will depend on the leaders. And of course, we will see how they spin progress. To me, if there is a commitment to working level talks, then I will be satisfied. I would like to see a common definition of denuclearization, meaning denuclearization of the North, rather than the mistaken the mistake made by President Moon and President Trump to adopt North Korea's narrative of denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula. And even though there's no nuclear weapons in South Korea, nor have there been since 1991, North Korea looks at the presence of U.S. troops, extended deterrence, the nuclear umbrella not only over South Korea but Japan, as the South being nuclearized. And so the security guarantee that the North wants is an end of the alliance, removal of troops, end of the nuclear umbrella, and extended deterrence, because that is what will ensure security to the North in Kim Jong-un's mind. And so there needs to be a definition of denuclearization of the North, not of the entire Korean Peninsula. The commitment to denuclearization should include a framework and a timeline or a roadmap for denuclearization, a commitment to inspections, but again, most importantly, a commitment to working level negotiations to work out the details, and that's really what is necessary to do that. Because without the working level negotiations, there will only be talk and rhetoric from Kim and Trump.
The world waits with bated breath. Colonel Maxwell, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
You're very welcome.
We've been joined by retired Army Colonel David Maxwell, Senior Fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.